Good evening, everyone. This is Terry Lynn Coop, host of the Blue Plate Special, and tonight on the menu is J.D. Rhodes, author, lawyer, and sometimes columnist. He is a best-selling author, attorney, and he has won an award or two for that columnist thing. He attended the University of North Carolina, where he says he majored in spelling, and then went on to the UNC's creative writing program, which resulted in him not writing another word of fiction for about 13 years, unless you count legal briefs. And as a lawyer myself, I can say that occasionally those legal briefs do qualify as fiction. But someone talked him into writing a novel, and that's where we've ended up today, with him having both his Jack Keller and Tony Wolf Tim Buckthorne series. How you doing tonight, J.D.?
I'm doing great, Terry. Thanks for having me tonight.
That's what you get for putting up your bio on Amazon.
Yeah, I need to change that. That thing's been up about 5 or 6 years. I need to come up with something else. I've also got another one that's more outlandish on Goodreads.
It does need to be updated a little bit to talk about your new books, particularly the newest Jack Keller book. Was it Hellbound?
Right.
Hellhound on my trail.
Hellhound on My Trail. It's the title. The title's taken from a Robert Johnson song.
That's excellent. I was going to ask you where that came from. I'm going to dial it back a little bit before we get into your series and tell you that your independently published ebook, Lawyers, Guns, and Money, is just one of my absolute favorites.
Well, thank you. Yeah, that one was a real labor of love for me, and I've got a couple of my colleagues who were saying, like, you know, I've seen a line I've used in there. Why you need? I think you owe me some money. You know, because I stole Andy Cole. I stole some of his best lines from some of my colleagues. The one where he's telling his young associate, you see, son, if you're a lawyer, you're like a jukebox. You don't make any noise till they put the money in. That's taken directly from one of my colleagues who now says I owe him money.
Hey, but that is absolutely perfect. And believe me, as a small town lawyer, I recognized a lot of it. The clients, the mood, the attitude. Also, at the time when I read that, I was kind of struggling with my first book. It just wasn't working. The POV and everything wasn't working. And after reading Lawyers, Guns, and Money, that's when I went to the first person POV.
Right.
And that's when the book came together. It worked. It really worked in your book, and I think it worked in mine. So I just can't, even though that one's kind of fallen down the list as you've been working on your two series. Anyone who's a fan of legal thriller, legal fiction, I can't recommend that one enough.
Well, thank you very much. I mean, I always wanted to write a legal thriller that was a little bit more realistic, you know, than the standard legal thriller. I mean, you know, I wanted to, you know, in a lot of these, the lawyer, you know, he'll have one case, he'll have one client. You know, that's a quick way to the poorhouse for a lawyer. And I remember Ed McBain wrote a series about a lawyer in Florida named Matthew Hope who only defended people he knew were innocent. And that, I was like, I almost threw that first one across the room because I said, this man obviously is not fond of eating regularly.
Exactly.
So I wanted to write one where, you know, you're pretty sure that your client actually did it, you know, you're just trying to mitigate the damage as best you can. You don't just have one client. You don't just have one case. You know, you've got to try to keep your doors open with the other ones. So there's a scene in there where Andy is, you know, he's going over the cases that are still pent that, you know, he's got to sort of foist off on his young associate to handle. And that's one of my favorite scenes. So that's when I get to make a lot of, you know, commentary on the legal system.
Oh.
You know, about
well,
how he
and,
tells him you got to pick the right judge for this case because more important than knowing the law is knowing your judge, which is absolutely true.
I have it in Tulsa County, Oklahoma. They would assign the judges. They had a little spinning rack that had the judges' stamps on it.
Really?
And every time they assigned a case, they'd turn the little spinner a quarter turn.
Right.
Well, I got to know that really quickly, and I would let people go ahead of me in line to file their cases.
That's brilliant.
Until the judge I wanted was next up on the little spinner. I was able to do that for at least a dozen cases or so and get the and why, that's forum shopping right there. Hell yes, it
is. That's it. Well, it's not just obviously you do a certain amount of judge shopping to the degree that they'll let you, but also, you know, if you know your judge, it's not just a matter of picking ones that you think are going to be more friendly to you. You're going to pick the ones, or try to pick the ones that you know what they want to hear. You know,
yes.
You know what sort of things about your client are going to interest them. Some judges, you know, for better or for worse, they want to know if your client's, you know, going to church regularly. You know, they or some judges want to know if your client, you know, have kids or that he or she is supporting. You know, you got to know what they're interested in. So, and that's why it's real important to know the judge.
Exactly, and the kind of fact patterns too. Like I know one judge in particular; she was extremely interested in a certain type of custody case, and so that'd be me standing there going, "Oh no, you go ahead of me. No, please go ahead. Please go ahead.
Right.
Oh, wait, my turn."
Right.
Exactly. Yes, the good old.
And when
days.
The good one comes up, you know, you're sort of elbowing people out of the way. You know, I want this.
Oh,
I like that spinning rack thing. That's pretty interesting. There's a sort of not randomly assigned. They're just assigned by rotation in a civil court here.
Yeah, that was one of the ways, because Tulsa County is a big jurisdiction, and that was just one of their little ways of dealing with the chaos of, you know, you'd walk in there and there'd be four or five clerks that each had 10 or 15 people in line.
Right.
And
right,
it was a
file.
Matter of picking the line and everything else. That's where I came up. I went to school at University of Tulsa, and I worked as an intern in the prosecutor's office there. And like I said, that's where I kind of just came up, and then from there went on to legal aid, and then we moved up here to Kansas, and I became a public defender.
God love you.
And,
that's back with work.
It's who was, honestly, people ask me why I did it, and I said it's who was hiring at the time, you know.
Well, there's that.
But it did. It was very interesting work. And the thing about innocent clients, I mean, I think I can think of one that who was truly and utterly freaking innocent.
Mm-hmm.
As in, he was completely framed. I mean, just completely framed.
Right.
And we were actually going to take it to trial.
Right.
And but I'm like... and that's where I've used in legal work occasionally, you know, the lawyer's greatest nightmare, the innocent client.
Well, yeah, that's what he says and what Andy says in Lawyers, Guns, and Money.
Yeah.
The innocent client is the worst thing in the world, you know.
Well, for one thing, the stakes are immediately ratcheted up by about a factor of 10.
Exactly.
And I've always said, too, the guilty are just so much more pragmatic about their situation.
if you can mitigate the damage, they're happy. Yeah.
The innocent keep on insisting that they're, you know, innocent.
So, I've had a couple that were, well, you know, a lot of the time, as it turns out, and I tell this story a lot, what the question is not are they innocent, but are they actually guilty of what they're charged with?
Yes.
You know,
yes.
Because, I mean, they may be charged with, I mean, I had a guy, or actually it was when I was a law student, I was clerking for an attorney. Who had a client who, long story short, had accidentally shot his best friend. They were two good old boys. Oh, yeah, they're two good old boys out drinking tequila, you know, out in front of the stop and go. And, you know, when they started arguing, one of them pulled a gun out and started waving it around, had his finger on the trigger and blew his friend's head off, you know, all over the window. And, you know, that old boy was in our office, and he was crying like a child. He was saying, you know, I didn't mean to hurt nobody. He's my best friend. I didn't mean him any harm. Well, they charged him with first-degree murder, which is murder,
hell,
as we know from our reading, with premeditation and deliberation. Clearly not what he was guilty of. What he was guilty of, if anything, was involuntary manslaughter, which in layman's terms basically means the defendant was doing something incredibly stupid and somebody got killed.
Exactly.
You know, and so that's what part of a lot of defense actually ends up being, you know, figuring out what your guy actually did and fitting, you know, and then figuring out if you plead him to that and mitigate the damage. See if you can get him probation, you know, rather than a lengthy prison sentence. So,
Yeah, like that guy did not need to be in prison, you know.
No, exactly. Well, he did. He did about 2 years, and now I mean, I still see him around. He's a deacon in his church. He's married. He's got three kids. He's a foster parent. I mean, it's amazing.
And that's one, too, where, like, the other guy's family, you know, they can settle that out in civil court, that type of thing.
Well,
I had one. Luckily, nobody got hurt, but two guys were out at our local bar Drillers. And no good story starts out with a salad. It always starts out at Drillers in this town. Well, they decided they were too drunk to drive, so they walked home, probably about a mile. And when they got there, they realized that the guy who owned the house had left his keys back at Drillers. They have the big key bowl there. They couldn't get in the house. So the guy who actually owns the place is trying to figure out what to do. His buddy picks up a rock and hucks it through one of the windows.
Right. An elegant, simple and elegant solution.
They
start
doing
this.
Yeah, exactly. And then the other buddy is like, what the fuck, you know? And they start this like drunken slap fight out in the lawn. And somehow one of them pulls like a little pocket knife that has like a 1-inch blade.
Oh, dear.
The other one picks up a piece of glass. Well, they end up scratching each other all over the place.
Right.
And by the time the cops and the 911 gets there, they're both on their back, laying on their back, scratched up, laughing their asses off.
Right, butt charred along with a deadly weapon.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the other lawyer and I were both in the DA's office going, come on, because this was one of those truly situations where you go, let's not ruin these guys' lives.
Exactly.
For what they did when they were drunk. You know, they were like 22. Mm. And I think we ended up, my catch-all for situations like that was disorderly conduct.
Yeah, I was going to say, there's got to be some kind of consequence for that kind of drunken stupidity, but it doesn't need to be a felon, you know.
And in Kansas, disorderly conduct, I would basically ask them, I go, did it get loud and stupid? And, oh, yeah, good, we got it.
Yeah,
but
absolutely.
It has a provision in it for brawling, which is evidently the great state of Kansas has decided is different than fighting, as in battery. We were basically able to get them a $300 ticket for brawling. You know.
There you go.
But,
well, we call that a fray. A fray basically means we don't know who started this fight. We just walked in on it.
Exactly. And did it get loud and stupid? Yes, Your Honor, it did. So yeah.
Class 2 misdemeanor, probation. You know, unsupervised probation. Go out and don't do this no more.
Yeah, pay the court costs and attorney's fees and get the hell out of my courtroom. Yeah, it used to be pay the man the $2. Now it's pay the man the $200.
We have a thing in North Carolina called the private warrant, which is where it is a warrant that any person can go and take out on any other person without any police involvement at all. I could go into a magistrate's office in North Carolina and say, Terry Lynn Coop, you know, hit me with a baseball bat. And you'd get served with a warrant and have to appear in court and say, you know, and so we call those cases slap and claw cases. And every other Friday morning is when slap and claw cases come up. And boy, they ought to make a reality show out of that. I mean, there's high drama and low tragedy. I mean, it's like, it's crazy. And a fair amount of just, you know, the courtroom just erupts in laughter about 3 or 4 times a morning, you know, when we do that.
You need to work that into a book. You really need to work that in. Oh, which
I
one?
Have. Well, it's several of them. I'm trying to remember which one. But, you know, a lot of times when you got defendants standing up trying to tell their own stories, you know, trying to represent themselves.
Oh, yeah.
As my mentor at the criminal law clinic at the University of North Carolina once said, that poor bastard thought the truth would set him free.
Oh, yeah. It's like, oh no. Yeah, well, you know, they did teach us a thing or two in law school. It doesn't always seem like it, but one or two. I had one guy that I swear will get the books. It was a pretty serious case. It was actually a pretty serious case. There happened to be the damn state trooper was heading home after his shift. But this guy's a real, I mean, he's an excellent cop, but he's a real Boy Scout. So he did not stop for the day until he calibrated his speed gun.
Well,
my client comes ripping down Margrave, you know, doing 90 miles an hour, and the chase was on. And it ended up just being a complete and utter mess with about three or four felonies and about 10 trailing traffic ones. Well, I convinced the county attorney to basically give him the plea deal of a lifetime because, you know, I just happened to catch her at one of those times when she was willing to play let's make a deal. And I convinced the kid to take it. And then he comes back the next time I see him and goes, no, I want a trial. My sister, who's a first-year criminal justice student at the community college, looked this up on the internet and says that they don't have a case.
Right. Love those.
Yeah. Well, he ended up going down on all 9 counts. You know, because there was, there was just no, you know. So instead of a year's probation, he ends up with I think he did about 6 months in, and then he ended up with the highest criminal history score that there is. You know, basically stub your toe when you're going to DOC type of thing. It's like, you showed me, bro.
Got a lot of those helpers.
Yeah, you showed me, bro.
Yeah, you got to love those helpers. You know, somebody says, well, my brother-in-law says, you need to get me this and that. And I'm like, your brother-in-law can try the damn case if you want him to.
Precisely. Back in my very, very brief time doing divorces, a woman came in. She was the sister of my client. She says, well, while you're doing all this court stuff, I'm going to be working in the background.
Oh, good. Thank you so much.
And that's when I basically said no, and I got out of that one and learned really quick why I'm not suited for domestic work. But now, books.
Let's talk books.
Yes, Jack Keller. Well, those are good too because we talk about, like with Lawyers, Guns, and Money, how you write lawyers.
Mm-hmm.
Because lawyers are great characters.
Oh, yeah.
And I told someone this once. I was critiquing their work, and I said, no, you're not catching the lawyer right. Lawyers are not – we're not stupid as in low IQ. I mean, even the worst of us got through 7 years of school. We're arrogant, we're arrogant, we're burned out, we're gormless, we're a lot of other things, but we're not stupid. So make sure that the motivations come out of something a lot more sinister than that.
Yeah, exactly. I will say I know one or two lawyers that are just bloody stupid, but they're very rare. There's lawyers who I say, I don't know how this guy actually made it through law school, but I'm not naming any names. For the majority of them, they're smart, they're well educated, and they love to talk. You know, so they make great characters to write.
We get caught up in a lot of other things and a lot of other motivations, but pure stupid usually isn't one of them. And she improved the character doing that. But now on the opposite of a lawyer, we have Jack Keller, a guy who needs a lawyer.
Right. And, he's got a really good lawyer named Scott McCaskill who works out of Fayetteville, North Carolina. And Scott is sort of always the lawyer I would have aspired to be. You know, he's got great hair. You know, he's really good. He knows everybody. You know, at one point he bluffed somebody by saying, well, you know, I could go wake Judge Jones up, but I don't think you'd like what happened to you if I did. You know, so he's a great character to write.
Yeah, Scott, I mean, he is a great supporting character to Jack Keller. But now, how many Keller books are there now? What number is Hellhound?
there are the Hellhound on My Trail is the fifth Jack Keller book. And every one I say, okay, this is the last one. Because I, you know, how much more can I put that poor bastard through? I mean, he's already, he's lost the love of his life, twice. You know, he's got a constant case of PTSD that keeps getting made worse by the fact that he keeps getting in the middle of these, you know, incredibly violent situations. You know, his best friend and therapist tells him at one point, you know, Jack, it's hard to treat somebody for post-traumatic stress disorder when he gets still gets shot at all the time. But it's the fifth one, and I'm writing a standalone right now, but after that I'm contracted to write a sixth Jack Keller book, so that's going to be
interesting. Well, of course. Well, and two, in Hellhound, you start out, you've reached the point in that in Keller's story arc where he's doing the burnout, trying to start over.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you either, and it, when you're doing that, you either move to the mountains or the desert.
Right.
And things don't quite work
out.
He's
living out in the desert, working at a little bar out there with his you know, young woman who owns it. And, you know, they obviously have feelings for one another. And he's just trying to, you know, just trying to live day by day and just live a peaceful life. And what happens is somebody shows up who's an emissary from Jack's long lost father, who, you know, we established early in the series that Jack was raised by his grandmother because his single mother was kind of a flake. And we don't mm-hmm. really know much about his father except that he was a sailor at the naval base in Charleston. Well, as it turns out, after he was a sailor at the naval base in Charleston, he went on to do some, you know, fairly severe things for his country. He basically became a, you know, a spook, mm-hmm. and has lived a long and bloody life, and now is feeling guilty and he's dying. His father's dying and wants to see Jack for one last time. And that Jack at first resists it, but then, you know, the guy is such a master manipulator. I'm not spoiling too much because this happens in like the first few chapters of the book.
Yeah.
The guy's such a master manipulator. He gives Jack a look at the gun camera from the helicopter that killed his squad, you know, in a friendly fire incident.
Whoa.
I mean, that's the first thing, you know, the sort of inciting incident for all of Jack's problems is when he was in the first Gulf War and he saw his entire squad wiped out by a helicopter in a friendly fire incident. And now his father shows him the gun camera and says, I know who did this. I can tell you what happened. You have to come see me. And so,
well,
Jack,
and he knows how to get to Keller. He knows that's the one
right.
thing that would get him. And
because
I
he's a ruthless son of a bitch. I mean, he's just a terrible, yeah. he's a terrible, terrible person.
And I presume that mayhem ensues from that point.
Right, because there's a young or a woman who is trying to build on her father's legacy. His father was a U.S. senator. Who was connected with this guy, with Jack's father, and the daughter, who has senatorial aspirations of her own, finds out that you know, this guy's trying to reveal something, the father is trying to reveal something, and she assumes that it's something damaging about her father, which would destroy her career. So she moves into all of these really bad characters to try to stop Jack and his father from being together.
Ooh. Oh, it sounds great. And on this, I always ask this about series characters. Is this enough standalone that someone could just pick it up and they'd get a sense of who Jack Keller is?
Yeah, I think it is. I certainly try very hard to do that. I try to weave in enough of the backstory. It's difficult to do, and that's frankly why these get harder and harder to write every time, because you've got to make sure that there's enough backstory in there so that the reader, if that's the first Keller book he or she is picking up, you know, can comprehend the story and comprehend and have some emotional connection to it. You know, I often tell people, people ask you, so, well, do I need to have read all the other ones? I say, well, no, you don't have to. You'll understand what's going on. You may have more of an emotional connection if you go back, you know, to and pick up the first few books, because you then will have been with him throughout the whole thing, but you'll know what's going on. But that gets harder and harder to do.
And I can well see that. If someone wanted to jump into the Jack Keller series, where do you think it'd be a good place to do it?
Well, I always say start with the first one, the devil's right hand. And that, by the way, a little shameless self-promotion here. That one's actually been optioned for television.
Awesome.
The company Anonymous Content, who made The Revenant and Mr. Robot and True Detective, has picked up an option for that. So, you know, hopefully that'll pan out into something. But that's, they've got some, interest in the rest of the series. I don't want to go into all the details of the deal, but the whole series may end up being on TV. But they want to start with The Devil's Right Hand. So I suggest, obviously starting with that one. It's right now, it's harder to find in paper because it's easy to find on ebook. It's published through Polis Books, who's done the ebooks for Nook and Kindle and Apple and all that good stuff. So it's also, on Audible.
And I want to say to anyone who's listening that the Kindle ebook is on sale for 99 cents, and I've read it and I highly recommend it. It is quite the thrill ride. So you think the one that gives you what you need to know about Jack Keller, that you could pick the other books up and be able to have a sense of who this guy is.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Because that's the one where, again, you see from his perspective the incident that has basically affected the rest of his life. Although I do flash back to that some, in subsequent books, like in Safe and Sound, which is the third Jack Keller book. You could pick that up, and there's some things in there that and it's done in flashback, which you want to be very careful about. But, hopefully it happens. The flashbacks happen fast enough that you're not rolling your eyes and going, "Oh my God, another long flashback." So,
the screen gets hazy.
That's the problem.
And,
right, exactly. I mean, the problem with putting in that backstory is you don't want to do just this long multi-page info dump,
Yes.
Because that just stops the story dead in its tracks. And one thing I always want to keep doing, is keep the story moving as fast as I can. People told me that's one of the things they really like about it.
They definitely do move quickly, and that's what's enjoyable about them. I mean, I really enjoy this type of story, like Mark Graney's Gray Man series or Jonathan Gilstrap's Digger Grave series. We're talking some serious crossovers here between, like, Jack Kelly and Court Gentry and characters like that. I think this needs to happen.
Right.
I think it'd be a great anthology. And then, of course, I always tout this in Mark's book, Backblast. You actually get to see the aftermath of when you throw live ammo in a deep fryer.
Nice.
That is one of my favorite scenes ever. And I asked him about it, and he said, "You know what? Go to YouTube."
Somebody's actually done it.
Somebody's actually done it.
Oh, that's good. I'm going to have to look that up when we get off.
Oh,
here.
For sure. That's what John Gilstrap said too. He says, "You know what I'm going to do after this show, don't you?" And I said, "I wouldn't have it any other way."
YouTube has become such a great resource, because you can find, for instance, if you want to find what it looks like to be driving through a particular area. There are videos on YouTube. Somebody just took their dash cam and drove through, some particular area. The book I'm writing right now, some of the characters live in a little area of New Orleans called Araby, which is kind of really sketchy. My friend Tony McGee-Causey told me about it. It's a sort of really sketchy area of New Orleans, north of the river, sort of east of the quarter. And just to get a feel for the place, I went up to YouTube. There are several YouTube videos of people driving through Araby.
Oh, that's
cool.
Yeah,
it's real sketch. So I blow them up real big on the screen and say, okay, this is what it's like. This is what the buildings look like. And so,
And I've never done that. I'll usually use the Google Earth, type of thing where you plunk yourself down. Like in my book, I have a passage about the Dallas County Federal Courthouse.
Right.
And I just, yeah, that's it. Got in there and went there and was like, ooh, that's what it looks like. And there's the, oh, and there, and same thing, the FBI office in Austin, Texas, I think,
yeah,
or wherever it is in Texas. And I'm like, oh, that's, there's the security booth. And look, there's the, you know, there's the crash ballers,
right,
and all of that. And I was able to put all that in the book. And, you know, what did we do before that? It was, that,
uh-huh,
that's completely,
well,
awesome.
Another thing that I did when, you know, talking about doing research online is I had one, I'm trying to remember which book it was that involved, there were some scenes that were actually set in the FBI building in Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm.
And I had actually been there on a tour, but when I was like 13, and I couldn't remember much about it. So what I did was call up on Netflix, call a couple of old X-Files episodes up, you know, because they
perfect
actually filmed there, you know. You know?
That's that is an excellent idea. An excellent idea.
Oh yeah, Cole. I actually heard Lee Child once. I heard somebody say Lee Child said this. I have not actually heard Lee say it, but somebody said there, Lee Child talking about setting, is you don't have to make it totally accurate, but you can make it what look like what people have seen it on TV. You know, if people have seen it on TV, that's as good as you need to do. You know.
And
do,
well, and my friend Janet Reed, the agent, she calls that,
yeah,
the tang of authenticity.
Right.
And she'll use the example of The Wire. And she said, you know what? I don't know if cops and drug dealers talk like that, but that show convinces me that they do.
Right. Absolutely.
And
the only problem with doing
was,
research like that is you can go down the research hole for hours and hours and not actually get anything written.
At a conference, one of the presenters said something like, good research can make a 600-page book into a 500-page book.
Right.
Meaning that I've had half-hour conversations to get at the end, and at the end I go, oh, okay, so the answer is yes. Well, yeah,
right.
Okay.
Yeah, it's,
and
it's
the
hard
way
when
to
you
do
see
it. Go ahead.
Go ahead. Well, you know, what's really frustrating sometimes is to read a book where you can see that the author has done a lot of research and is putting every damn bit of it on the page.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
And I also like military thrillers, you know, Tom Clancy style, that
mm-hmm.
type of thing.
Yeah.
And I love Tom Clancy and Larry Bond. I mean, they're, you know, it's all full of sexy tech and everything, but there's
right.
not the grinding detail. And then
yeah,
I read another one. Go ahead.
Go ahead. One of the things I really learned from Tom Clancy as to how you get away from that
mm-hmm.
that grinding detail, and this is, you know, it seems so elementary now because I've been doing it for so long, but, you know, he'll get you to one part and then cut away. You know,
yeah.
He'll get you right up to a suspenseful scene and then cut away and then do something else and then cut back to it and then cut away again. And that's, you know, I read Hunt for Red October about four times. And, you know, that's one of the things I try to do because it's you know, what I try to do is so effective, you know, in not getting you bogged down in the tech.
And that's a good point that I never noticed before. It's like, we're going to cut away while you're calibrating all the equipment.
Right. Exactly. Exactly.
Do something different. And then we'll be back when you're actually ready to fire it.
Right. You know, there is one
yeah.
writer, and I'm not going to name any names because he's very popular and I've read several of his books and thoroughly enjoyed them. But at some point I have to stop and say, do I really need to know the brand of tactical gloves the Navy SEAL is carrying? You know, do I really need to know
yeah.
who made his damn gloves? I mean, you know.
Exactly. But, the one I was thinking of is this guy goes into just excruciating encyclopedic detail about how a carrier group is arranged.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you can do that in a few sentences, you know.
Or better yet, show it in some sort of dramatic way, you know, but we get into these,
right.
you know, overlapping circles of influence, you know, and it's just like, no, it was like reading a textbook after a certain point. So
right.
it's, Yeah, it's got to be contemporaneous with the action and built into the action. And now
right.
your next series, the Tony Wolfe Tim Buckthorn series.
Right.
I thoroughly enjoyed Breaking Cover.
Thank you. That's probably my most popular book besides the Keller series.
I just I loved everything down to it, to having the, and you're not the only one who does this, but I enjoy, like, having the storage bins set up as the hidey hole, and you know the
right.
the everything. I mean, it was just superb on that one. So, which one comes first? Is it Breaking Cover or Broken Shield?
Broken Shield is definitely the second one.
Okay.
And you know it was kind of difficult to write, because this is one where, you know, once, you know, the basic story of Breaking Cover, for those who haven't read it, is this guy was like, it's the best undercover agent the FBI ever had, and suddenly he had to disappear and go underground because he didn't trust the FBI anymore or the people that he was spying on. But mm-hmm. then something happens that draws him out, and he has to, you know, he gets on television. And so because he gets on television, or he gets found out by this reporter, he can't be an undercover officer anymore. You know, so when it's all over, and yes, he does survive because there is a sequel. So when he, you know, he's having to deal with the fact that he's now unable to do the thing that he most loved doing.
Mm-hmm.
So it really shifts more to Tim Buckthorn, who is the sheriff who he meets in Breaking Cover, who sort of, you know, doesn't trust him at first, but they actually end up being friends. And so, you know, Tim Buckthorn ends up, you know, trying to, you know, back in the, he's in the same town where Breaking Cover occurred, you know, and he's trying to protect his town from another menace, and Buckthorn is helping him. So really, I mean, you know, and a friend of mine once said, once they read Breaking Cover, said, you know, this is much Buckthorn's story as it is Wolf's. And that's sort of what I took the springboard for Broken Shield on, you know.
And that is true. That is true. That it, in that situation that they have to deal with in Breaking Cover, and he doesn't know, you know, Wolf is actually his good guy, but he's not that good of a guy, and he's got to try and bring order to the whole thing. Are there going to be any more Wolf Buckthorn books?
I have not planned any at this point. I'm not counting out the possibility, but, you know, right now I've got a standalone that I'm finishing, and then another Jack Keller book, and I haven't really thought beyond that, because that's going to take me probably to 2019. So,
what's up with the standalone?
The standalone, you know, every time I write a book, I say this is the hardest book I've ever written. but the standalone is, right now the working title is Fortunate Son. Basically, it's about these two brothers that were separated. They were taken from their mother, who's sort of this wild party girl, but she was only like, you know, 16 or 17, and you know, when she had them, and they were taken away from her by social services, because I did a lot of work in social services court.
Yes.
And you know, she eventually lost custody. They were adopted out to different families. Well, actually, one was adopted out to a good, you know, upright, small-town Christian family, and the other one just got bounced around through foster home to foster home. So, naturally, one grew up, you know, a straight arrow Boy Scout. The other one turned out to be a criminal. So, one day, the criminal finds out that the mother is now in New Orleans, and she's in some kind of trouble. So, he decides that he's going to kidnap the quote, good brother, the fortunate son, drag him down to help their mother.
Interesting.
It took me a while to get a handle on it, and then I went to New Orleans for BoucherCon, and I said, okay, well, some of this actually has to happen in New Orleans, because I just, you know, just fell in love with the city at that point. But not a lot of it, a little bit of it happens in the French Quarter, but not a lot of it. It mostly is in the sort of sketchier areas on the fringe of New Orleans. But, you know, the mother is involved with some very bad people, and so these boys are, you know, are going to be walking into a terrible situation. And the sheriff and the social worker who initially, you know, made the initial investigation that ended up with them being separated are trying to, you know, figure out where they're going and what they're doing. And, you know, they all end up, well, except the social where they all end up down in New Orleans, and that's where I am right now. So we don't know what bad shit's going to happen next.
Ooh. So when do you anticipate this one being out? Next year?
Next year, yeah. The due date is actually November. I should get it done well in advance of that. But this is one that's going to take a lot of revision. So I'm hoping to get the first draft done by mid-September, take a week of vacation, then come back and just whittle away at it until it's actually due.
And a question here. Tell me about Edward Fallon. What was that all about?
I've never met Edward Fallon in my life. I don't know who you're talking about. I don't know anything about him. Edward Fallon was a project that my friend Rob Gregory Brown came up with. It's now up to 7 books. But each one of them is written by a different author. But they all write under the pen name of Edward Fallon. That was a really interesting one to write because he wanted them, you know, fairly short. They're basically, it's like a serial. And we're fairly short. So that was a lot of fun to write because I could really pare a lot of stuff down. It turned out really well. I liked the whole series.
And I have to admit, you all totally had me going for the longest time. I could not figure out what the whole Edward Fallon thing was for the longest time. And then it was like, oh, okay. Well, aren't you all clever?
Yeah. We had the worst time coming up with that name because, you know, we wanted one single name for the whole project. And everybody would say, well, what about this? You know, Joshua Graves. Oh, well, no, there's a writer named Joshua Graves or somebody else. You know, mm-hmm. It's sort of like that thing, you know, where they had to, you know, where an actor has to pick a name that's not already registered with SAG. You know, if his name is actually Michael Douglas, he's got to change it to something else. So it took us days, you know, just all 6 of us throwing out, you know, different names and running it through Google and said, nope, that's already somebody else. And finally, we just decided, look, I'm sure there's going to be somebody named Edward Fallon, but if they're not a writer, to hell with it. You know, if they're not, stopping on anybody else's copyright.
Well, and two, I'm like, you know, who is this Edward Fallon? Because it's certainly nobody I've ever heard of before. And I consider myself to be pretty well versed in, you know, the thriller crime community and all of that. So, yeah, you guys had me totally going for a while. And I'm sure I'm probably not the only one. So, well done, sir.
Well, thank Rob Gregory Brown because it was his baby. I was just along for the ride. It was a blast to do. And, you know, I see what you mean because, you know, nobody's ever heard of Edward Fallon and suddenly he has 6 books out, you know, because we released them all at the same time, which was interesting because we sort of had to have a secret Facebook group, you know, where I wrote the second one. Rob wrote the first one, which was the, you know, sort of establish the characters and establish the basic situation and the villain, the beast, as he's called, mm-hmm. the serial killer that these 3 people are chasing. And so, you know, I sort of read that one, and then I had to do the second one, but every time I came up with something, I'd go on the group and say, okay, I'm going to do this. Does this screw up what anybody else is doing?
And that's critical, too, in that type of a serial, because you can't, you know, you've got to know if you kill somebody or anything else.
Right,
it's like,
right.
But wait, I have him married in the next book, you know, no.
Right, exactly. And, you know, I had some premises, you know, that I thought that I was just sort of throwing into the mix. And fortunately, everybody was like, oh, yeah, that's awesome. I can totally use that. You know, so like, all right.
Sweet. Well, it's a good series. And it sounds like it was actually a lot of fun to write and a little trick you were able to play on the rest of the community until it came out and became obvious what was going on. So well played, sir. Well played.
Thank you very much. And it was a lot of fun because it was also sort of out of my comfort zone because it was, you know, it's not the usual redneck noir that I write. It was like paranormal suspense,
mm-hmm.
you know, because one of the characters has these weird sort of paranormal powers, and you're not really sure, you know, at one point, one of my characters is a priest, says, are you an angel or a demon? And the kid just looks at him, you know, like, you'll never know. So that's, you know, I read a lot of that, and I enjoy a lot of that, but I've never tried to write it before.
Well,
so that was
didn't you take your hand at sci-fi back in the day?
Yeah. I wrote my, under the name of J.D. Nix, I wrote my my military sci-fi vampire novel.
As one does,
yeah. I really loved writing that book. It just didn't really sell all that well. It's gotten some good reviews, and I keep wanting to go back and write the sequel to that. I've got like the first four or five chapters of that mapped out. But, you know, I'd self-published that one. It's called Night Rider's Vengeance. So I self-published that one, and it never made a whole lot of money. So then I got, you know, actual paying work that publishers were willing to pay me for.
Yes.
So that sort of took precedence over my little vanity project there. So I may go back to that someday. I really enjoyed writing that character.
Well, and for the heck of it, just because I wanted to see if I could, I went into Kindle Worlds, which I don't know if you're familiar with that, but what it is essentially, sanctioned fan fiction. I wrote a novella in one of Hugh Howey's post-apoc just to see if I could do it.
Right.
And it was a lot of fun to do, and I actually think I'm going to revisit it and finish. You know, I finished the story, but I also left it open with possibilities.
Right.
And
that's always what you want to do.
And I seriously want to go back and revisit that because, you know, I did a written interview today where somebody was asking me, you know, how do you switch between genre? Because, you know, legal thriller and sci-fi. And I just answered, you know, it doesn't matter what the genre is. It's about compelling characters, you know, doing interesting things.
Right.
And
well,
I created.
You also have to know some of the rules of your genre.
Yeah.
I mean, you gotta figure out, you know, which subgenre you're in and what the rules of that are.
Right.
But yeah, if it's something you read on a regular basis, then you know it shouldn't be too hard to do.
And
but
I
yeah,
do.
You're
I read.
Right. You go back to the characters, and then you know, and the plot has to make sense. And beyond that, everything else is gravy. You know.
I mean, I could take in a future chapter, if I wanted to, I could take my boys, Jones and Kane, and throw them into some sort of, you know, dystopian post-apocalyptic court of law.
Yeah.
And, you know.
That would be interesting.
And examine, you know, what would law be like, you know, after the apocalypse type of thing. So. It's good characters doing interesting things. So yeah, you should when you get a hair, you should think about maybe revisiting the monster series because it sounds like it's a lot of fun.
Well, it ended up in a really intriguing thing. I mean, I'm not going to do any spoilers, but basically, you know, as it ends up, the entire universe changes. You know, all of the rules of the universe have suddenly changed due to some things that they set in motion at the beginning. You know, so they're going to have to live in this new world or this new universe that's totally different from everything they'd done before. So, yeah, I mean, it was a lot of fun.
And you can't do that in a legal thriller.
No, you really can't.
You can't just randomly change the universe.
Yeah,
I think
you can change the character's world, but you can't change the world itself unless he brings on a nuclear war.
I think I'll rewrite the laws of physics for this character. Nope, you can't do that one. So what are you up to as far as conventions and, you know, such?
The last one I went to was BoucherCon in New Orleans because I really wasn't going to miss going to New Orleans. I don't do a lot of those anymore. I'm not going to. Where's the BoucherCon this year? Is it in Toronto or Vancouver?
It's in Toronto.
It's in Canada. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
You know. Like, stupidly, I failed to update my passport. And, you know, the thing is, these damn things are really expensive. You know,
yeah.
And I got to, I may be doing more of them now that both kids are out of school. One's out of school and the other one's about to be. So, you know, I may end up doing more of them. There was a point when I first started that I did everything. I mean, every mm-hmm. you know, I went to Mayhem in the Midlands. I went to Murder in the Grove in Boise, Idaho. I mean, I would go to anything. And then I started looking at my credit card statements. And I'm
yes.
like, holy crap! this is
I can understand that one.
Yeah, that took a couple of years to dig out from under that loaded debt. So I'm going to be, I definitely want to go to VoucherCon, more VoucherCons, because that's the biggie. You know, that's the one where everybody goes to. But
well,
it's just, you know, you have to find something else to do with the money.
Next year it's in Florida. And I mean, I know I'm going to be there with bells on. We're probably going to be broadcasting from there. So I do hope to see you in Florida. Are you going to go up to Milwaukee again this year for Murder and Mayhem?
I may. I have had a blast at Murder and Mayhem, you know, as a presenter, you know, and I may just go up there as a guest, you know, mm-hmm. an actual patron. Because, you know, the John and Ruth Jordan, of course, are the hosts of that thing, and they and their crew up in Milwaukee are just absolute salt of the earth. I mean, they're some of the best people I know. And
oh,
just
I
to hang
it.
Out
I
with
mean-
them would be worth it.
That's where we actually met face to face for the first time was at Murder and Mayhem.
Yeah.
It was awesome. I had to miss last year's at the very last minute, and I just really regretted it. So, and I agree with you. I did my year of just one con after another, and I liked it. It helped me reconnect to the community because I
mm-hmm.
was out of it for a few years when my husband was sick. And it just
right.
helped me kind of reconnect to the community. But, yeah, then I looked at the credit card bills. So.
Right. And, you know, I made contact there that I've still – and not just contacts, but good friends
mm-hmm.
there that, you know, they're still – every now and then we'll end up working together. You know, that's how I met Rob.
Exactly.
Rob Gregory Brown and Brett Battles. So, you know, I definitely say, you know, go to the cons if you know if you're an aspiring writer, because you are going to make not just contacts but good friends that are going to be great people to hang with and can also you know throw work your way. So
well yeah. And at BCon it's just such an immersive experience. I'm hearing stories about Raleigh that you know I had no clue were going on because I was over there in that BCon over in the corner. You know, it's just this huge swirl around you that is just way too much fun. So cool.
Yeah.
I hope to see you either at Murder and Mayhem this year or at BCon next year for sure.
Yeah,
because
absolutely. Where in Florida is VoucherCon? Where in Florida is VoucherCon?
I want to say it's St. Pete's, but I mean they have a Facebook page for it, you know, with all
yeah.
of the info on it, and because it's going to be a lot of fun. It has been awesome talking to you. You are definitely going to have to come back, and because I'd like to talk more about writing these type of characters, you know, and what goes into them and what makes good cop characters and what makes good judge
right.
characters and that type of thing. Cause there's, you know, there's things you need to get in there
that I
see missed too often in books that I write. So definitely I'll schedule you back in and we'll just talk about creating these legal, you know, what to do when you want to create a legal world in there. So you game?
Absolutely. I'd love that.
All right. I'm doing a big three a week now through August is kind of my blitz month. And also the executive producer, Pam, needed a vacation. And then I'll settle into
it,
my.
Pam.
I know. And I can see why after doing these broadcasts three a week for the last three weeks.
Yeah.
I can see why she did. And then I'll settle into my normal Friday night slot. So I will be talking to you to come back in. I have a couple of housekeeping announcements I need to make before we leave. So I just wanted to say thank you for stopping by and
thanks
good luck on the new books. They look fantastic. And if you enjoyed this broadcast, it was made possible by the support of Down and Out Books. They're celebrating 6 years of award-winning crime fiction, and you need to go check them out at downandoutbooks.com. They have 6 Anthony Award nominations coming up at this year's VoucherCon. And this podcast is owned and copyrighted by the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network, LLC. You can follow us on Facebook to know what's on the menu for the Blue Plate Special. And thanks, everyone, for tuning in, and I'll say good night.